Court. Okay, good evening once again, everyone. Tonight, I want to do something a little different. For the past 6 weeks, we've been talking about Yaakov Avinu. And when we last left him, we left him on the cusp of the great reunion with his brother Esav. And we didn't quite make it to that reunion. So I actually want to try and do something tonight to actually create a little bit of closure to the conversation that we've been having over the past 6 weeks, but do it through the lens of the Megillah, and specifically through a number of Midrashim that help elucidate the Megillah. The way I want to start is by asking you this very simple question. Question is, why did Mordechai do it? Or really more precisely, why didn't Mordechai do it? What would have been the great tragedy in bowing down to Haman? Essentially, what the Megillah makes clear is that it was a result of Mordechai's intransigence that caused Haman to be so fired up, eish lahava, and to be so passionately opposed to the Jewish people that he wanted to wipe out all the Jews. So would have been so terrible, would have been so tragic for Mordechai for 10 seconds to swallow his pride, join everybody else, and just bow down. And as a result, the Jewish people presumably would never have been subject to the decree that Haman eventually propagated to attempt to destroy the Jewish people. And if you look just very briefly at sources number 2 and number 3, I've put on the source sheet other examples where it's pretty normal and pretty much okay for Jewish people to bow down to a superior, to a king, and it's not a life or death kind of issue. Look at source number 2. It's from Malachim Aleph. Okay, Nasan, the Navi, shows up in front of David and he bows down to him. Okay, so it's a Jewish king, it's a little different, but it's not that's not so terrible. Or in source number 3, you have the brothers and Yosef. They show up in Egypt, they don't even know that it's Yosef. They think he's an Egyptian viceroy. By Yosef, who Ashalit al Haaretz, who Mashpir lakol Am Haaretz, by Avo Achay Yosef, the brothers show up in front of Yosef, who's the viceroy of Egypt, and they bow down to him. No one says, there's no Gemara that says, how do the brothers bow down to a king or a viceroy or someone parading as a king? And also, you can't do it. What's the big deal? So before we get to some of the sources, any thoughts? Why was this the make-or-break issue for Mordechai? Why was he so forbent and so opposed to giving in to Haman for 10 seconds? Why did he refuse to bow? Any thoughts? Manny?
I think my take on it might mess up
one. No, you can't. You can't mess us up. We can only be creative. It can only... Shivan Panim Latar. It's called the hidden face of the Megillah. The worst that will happen is dealing with this, and it's also a complication that we haven't thought of before.
Where I'm coming from is, how come they allowed Mordechai not to bow down? Nobody said, throw him in jail. Nobody said, this is unheard of. There's a rule. He broke the rule. Nobody's saying that.
It's a great point. Just to interrupt you for a second, the Midrash actually picks up on that and says that there was opposition. I mean, there were other voices in the Jewish community that got really upset at Mordechai and said, what are you doing? You've endangered us, and now as a result...
Why didn't the Persians throw him in jail?
Oh, okay, that's an interesting question. Why didn't the Persians throw him in jail?
Now, there's a Midrash that says that Mordechai and Haman were both generals in the Persian forces, and both were competing, and there was a chance that Mordechai would be chosen by the king, there was a chance that Haman would be chosen by the king. Mm-hmm. Haman goes and bribes the king with money. He had this party, he was real, and he had this war with the Greeks. He was in real deep trouble for money, and it was easy to bribe him and get the Jews to that. So I think that Mordecai had power. He wasn't just a poor little Jew walking the streets.
Right.
And he had this power, and because he had power, he thought that he was equal, at least, to Haman, and therefore he wouldn't bow to him because he wanted to preserve the power. And the power was Bashar HaMelech. He was sitting in the court. He was a Supreme Court guy.
So you're saying it was really...
of this power that he got the spies to tell him about the plot, because he was centrally placed. So all of this hangs together,
right,
and would lead him not to bow down to Haman.
So you're saying, in principle, it's really an ego trip.
No, power...
It's protecting the territory.
It's a power struggle.
And in reality, he just dragged all the Jews into it for no reason at all, but because he was like, you know, he had absolutely no regard for the Jewish community, was willing to endanger everybody's life for his own...
So you read it critically, that Mordecai was guilty...
Because
go ahead.
If you read it a different way, hey, if you know that this guy Haman is going to be there, and you don't want to bow down to him, then if there's a halakha reason not to bow to him, mm-hmm, then the first thing you do is you don't go there. You don't hang around where you have to do something that halakha is not. Don't put yourself in a position,
right,
of the halakha approaches. You don't put yourself in a position where you have to do the nevera. If it's wrong, if it's nevera to bow down to him, then don't hang around there. Okay? If you're not going to look at it from a halakha lens, if you're looking at it just from the standpoint that, hey, you don't want to bow to him because you shouldn't, because it's
right,
hey, if you're a leader in the Jewish community, what you're doing is you're walking into this situation and you're jeopardizing everybody. You're putting everybody in danger for your own whatever reasons.
Okay.
But certainly there's no moral justification for doing it.
Okay. Anyone have it? That's a pretty extreme extreme view, but it's hard to argue with it. Anyone have a different thought? Maybe it's not so extreme.
If he's not doing it because of the bowing, but because of the money, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
He's brought it.
Okay. Very interesting.
Now, if you look at the Venezuelan community today, they are saying, don't run the boat. Don't complain about Chavez.
Yeah.
Don't get the American Jewish community to make waves.
Yeah.
Because if we keep a low profile, nothing bad will happen.
Okay, I want to come back to that point, what it means to keep a low profile. What do you mean by that, Alan? The Jews should have been here in the first place. They should have been in Israel. Okay.
So, I mean, to say that we took low profile, so I mean, it's...
Okay, that's a great point too, and there's this subtle and sometimes not so subtle critique of the Jewish community in Persia in the Megillah for their failure to view Israel as the central homeland of the Jewish people. But that's for a different conversation. Any other thoughts before we turn to the sources? Okay, have a look at source number five. This is really just a parenthesis. Source number five, the Megillah says in Perek Gimel, "Vayikyam Rami Lav Yom Vayom." Yeah, let's actually just look at source number one. I have the whole text for you. These six psukim at the beginning of the third chapter, where we have this narrative, and source number five is just excerpted from that from those six psukim. Source number one: Achar Hadvarim Ha'ileh Yigal Amalach Kasherosh Esanam Ben Ha'am Betasah Hagadi Vaynasehu. Haman raises the level, the status of Haman to some kind of princeship. He made him the highest courtier in the land. Verse number two, and all the servants of the king who were present at the king's gate bowed and prostrated themselves to Haman. Because that was what the king demanded. Mordechai, lo yifah v'lo yishtachaveh, but not Mordechai, he didn't bow, he didn't prostrate himself. Vayomer avdei ha-melech, asher b'shar ha-melech le-Mordechai. Madua atah uberes mitzvas ha-melech. The servants of the king said to Mordechai, why do you violate the king's command? Vayikam ram, here's the key line, verse number four. Vayikam ram elav yom vayom. It was like this every day. It wasn't just a one-time affair, but this repeated, day in, day out, Haman would show up, everyone else would bow, and Mordechai would remain erect, refusing to bow. And they'd walk over to him and say, "Why don't you bow, you bum?" And he never listened to them. Day in, day out, he refused to bow. They tried to persuade him to bow. He didn't give in. Okay. So just as a parenthesis, by the way, this was made known to Haman. They told him that Mordechai was Jewish, which indicates quite explicitly that Mordechai made no outward show of his Jewishness. If he was wearing a yarmulke and had a beard and his tzitzis out, they wouldn't need to tell him that this guy was Jewish. Clearly, I just say this as a parenthesis, clearly Mordechai wasn't parading around as Mordechai the Jew. That comes out of the story later, but as of this moment, he seems actually to be, I would say, blending in.
But if they don't say that he's a Judean until this point, the dispute between Haman and Mordechai was earlier. So it was not a religious dispute. It had to be some...
At least it wasn't an explicit religious dispute. Meaning, he could have been, as we'll see in a moment, meaning he could have been hiding his Judaism, but still... holding close to his convictions.
Or should have been.
Sorry, Charles, go ahead.
Or it could be that, you dress like a Jew, but, if you're in New York, and people see you with a black hat, and you walk Shabbos in the morning to show them the talisman over your overcoat, then people know you're Jewish.
Right.
On the other hand, if you do it in Omaha, they would know, they might not understand what you are. Or if you do it in Beijing, or if you do it somewhere where they don't know you're Jewish, they don't know you're Jewish.
So you're saying Haman may have never even seen a Jew, not known a Jew.
Or if he had seen one, it may not have even registered to him that he's not Jew.
It could be. David?
Haman doesn't object to anything until the next pasuk.
Right. It was only. Right. That is a fair point. Now I just wanted to demonstrate again. This is just the parentheses. We'll come to the answers in a moment. But in source number 6, I just excerpted for you a line from the Yosef narrative. There are many connections between Yosef and Mordechai throughout the Purim story, and we'll come to that maybe on a different night for a different shiur. But one of them is actually this line. If you compare Pasuk Dalet in source number 1, which I've also put as source number 5, with the formulation of source number 6, the enticements of Asheth Potiphar, what happens? In source number 6, Vayiki Dabral Yosef Yom Yom Velo Shama Eleh Lishkav Etzal Yosima. It's a very similar formulation. This went on day in and day out, Velo Shama. But he refused to listen. So I would just, and again, this is not key to the argument that I'm going to make in a few moments, but I would just point out, and this goes on throughout the Megillah. Megillah, relative to the rest of Tanakh, Tarnavim, is a very late text. The expectation is that the reader has imminent familiarity with the Torah and with Nevi'im, and so there are often hints intended for the knowing reader to highlight a particular theme or to highlight a particular message. I wouldn't put it past the author of the Megillah to be calling on this line from the 39th chapter of Bereishis to just sort of emphasize to us, you should just know this was the same level, in some form or fashion, as Yosef, day in and day out, putting off the overtures of Asheth Potiphar. This is the kind of struggle that Mordechai had to deal with on a daily basis. Okay. Yeah, Alan.
I don't seem to get the connection, really, but I seem to think the Megillah was written not so much, Jews didn't really have a really fair play in writing it, because it was written in the Persians, pretty much in command, not the Jewish people, so they couldn't really have authoritative, when they were writing.
No, but if you look through the Megillah, you'll find a lot of references and a lot of subtle pieces that would only be known to a Jewish readership that was eminently familiar with the text of the Torah. So we could talk about it afterwards, but you'll see 100.
Somebody wrote the Megillah. Somebody was trying to Jewish people are on the brink of distinction.
People who wrote this wrote it
after we exactly
this was written by the winners, not by the losers.
Right, that's a great point.
Many of the different connections.
Okay, you're saying theologically we may have done some things which weren't.
People becoming Jews because they're afraid of us. The whole world, everything.
Yeah, the Messiah. I think you're right. Okay, but I say this just as an aside.
What kind of winners were we?
Okay.
Can I just ask one question?
Okay, Sylvia, and then I want to see source 7.
How come Hashem's name is never mentioned?
Okay, we'll come back to that on a different occasion. Okay, source number 7. The bottom of page 1. So the Medrash says the following. Medrash says, speaking at Tziva HaMelech, Shehu Kari Mishtachavim La. So the Megillah says that it was a king's command to bow down to Haman. So Ma'asa Haman. So knowing that, what did Haman do? This is the Medrash saying, Asu Lo Tzelem Yirukam Al Bigadav V'Al Libo. V'chol ma shahaya mishtachavel aman, hay mishtachavel avodas kochavi. So Haman had the Medrash says had a real trick up his sleeve. What did he do? He embroidered into his garment or whatever he was wearing some tzelem, some image of, some pagan image, some idolatrous image, and anyone who bowed down to him would, by dint of bowing down to him, naturally be bowing down to that idol. And this is the Medrash, or the strand of the Medrash that the Ibn Ezra picks up on. Source number 8, verse the second side of your handout. So what does it mean? He's answering our question. Why didn't Mordechai bow down? Why didn't he do it? So Yiduin benachon mashadarshu razal. It's known and it's correct. What Chazal say in the Medrash we just saw, ki tsuras tzelem v'yavodazara hayu b'begadav, olal mitznafto, that somewhere either on his sash or on his clothing was this image of an idol. So Mordechai wanted to avoid at all costs, right? It's not just fun and games. It's actually one of the big three. It's a cardinal sin. You have to stand on ceremony. Somebody says, bow down to an idol or I'll kill you. You got to take one for the team. Yahara gal yagur, you can't bow down to that idol. Answer number 1 of 4 answers that I want to look at. The Medrash, cited by the Ibn Ezra, Mordechai refused to bow. Mordechai wasn't a bad guy. Mordechai was a frum, upstanding member of the Jewish community, and he refused to bow down to an idol who this tricky guy Haman was setting everyone up to bow down to. Charles, you don't like it.
Well, I mean, you could like it if you want to think, if you want to force yourself to take a midrashic approach towards things which categorically can be read without any content, without any midrashic gloss, and make sense. Like a million other things, you can take a midrashic approach towards something which doesn't have a Jewish context, and force a Jewish context on it to justify what somebody is doing, what somebody has done, to make them seem, if you want to play them up, you can turn Mordechai into a tzaddik, which is certainly not necessary to understand the story, and you can turn Haman into this, instead of just a murderer, instead of just Hitler, he's Hitler running the Crusades. Okay, if that's what you want, you can do that. But that's a lens. And if you want to talk about lenses that you're viewing things, that's a lens that existed for about 125, 150 years, which we've then used for the following 1800 years to view everything through.
Okay.
And it becomes uncomfortable for us to say, hey, we're not comfortable with that lens because that's the lens that's printed in our textual material.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because it sounds like you have an allergy to Medrash.
No, I don't have an allergy to Medrash. On the other hand, there are, I'm uncomfortable with midrashic interpretation when it seeks to layer frumkeit, or when it seeks to layer halacha onto a maisa. And that's why this,
okay.
if we would interpret, or if we would back, if we would step back and take the first midrash in Rus, or one of the first midrashim in Rus, to look at Esther, we'd feel a lot more comfortable. One of the first midrashim in Rus says, Engo, Isser of the Engo, Heter Engo, there's no, it's not, don't look at it through a lens of halacha. Because when you look at this, if you start looking at Megillah Esther through a lens of halacha, you either destroy the story, or even worse, you'll see how you can further undermine halacha.
Okay, yeah, I would take issue with, let's say everything that you just said.
Okay.
But I would just start with two important points. One is I don't want you to be allergic to Medrash.
Okay.
And what you just said, it made you uncomfortable. Meaning you're allergic to at least Midrashim that use a halachic or, let's say, Yiddishkeit
lens. A halachic spin
okay.
to justify what the denigrates of.
Okay, so hold on to that, because I want to return. That's a very important point. And the second is, we have a Masara that goes all the way back to the Mishnah of the Gemara to use halacha as the lens by which to view the Tanakh.
And then we have a counter Masara, which says let's not. And for example, the Ramban on Bereshis. Place after place, will say don't use that halakhic lens. All right, so we have counter masoras on that also.
Right, all and right. we're coming to that in a we're coming to that in a minute. But what I want to
remember that is the rabbis who absorbed and accepted the Megillah, and it had a meaning for them.
It's a great point.
It wasn't just a secular.
Yeah. Well, either that
they have to sit around and decide.
But hold on to one for one second.
I think it had a very important.
Because what I wanna come to is actually to hopefully share with you how the Medrash can deepen our understanding of the text itself. Now sometimes the Medrash can rub us the wrong way, or as Charles has put it, meaning why resort to the Medrash when you don't have to? You're saying the text can be understood on its own merits, maybe have enough information in the text itself to be able to answer the questions without having to resort to these allegories. Now, I just want to, and I've made this argument before, I just want to demonstrate for you in the next few minutes that Medrash is actually much more sophisticated and much more important than we sometimes give it credit for. Because the authors of the Medrash are extremely sensitive readers and extremely sensitive to the nuances and subtleties of the text. And they're picking up on the gaps and the holes in the text that require filling in. So you don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater just because some answer doesn't quite fit in or doesn't quite answer all the problems. Doesn't mean that the Medrash hasn't actually provided us a great service by at least posing the questions, proposing a potential means by which to explore the answer. So let me just expand on that by looking at the coming answers. Okay, so path number one, which I'm glad you felt so viscerally about, because it's hard. We're superimposing a halachic tradition on Mordechai that he may or may not have had, and it requires us to assume that Haman isn't just a power-hungry guy, which seems like the Haman described in the Megillah, but we also have to impugn his motives and say that he is actually out to deceive anyone who might be bowing to them and to place an idol on his person such that all Jews would then be... We don't know that he was an idolater, so you're right to say that it makes you uncomfortable, but Ibn Ezra, who was a pshat guy, likes this Medrash. So at the very least, that's an important point. Okay. Rashi takes it to an even further
to an even further extreme in source number 9 on page 2. Kurim Mishtachavim, why didn't Mordechai bow to Haman? Because you know what Haman did? She'asa atzmo Eloha. It wasn't just that Haman embroidered some deity onto his garment and somehow thereby create the process of idolatry to for anyone who would be bowing down to him. He made himself into a god. That's why Rashi, the Megillah, tells us that Mordechai refused to bow down because Haman was walking around saying, I'm a god.
So he was basically like the Romans were, the Roman Caesars. Yes,
something like that. A para,
a
something along those lines.
The way I would understand Rashi would be, if the king said bow down to me, he would say bow down to my imperial position. So that's not making himself into a god. But Haman was less than a king and requires bowing down, okay. So therefore he's making himself into a god.
That's very nice. I think that's that could be, in fact, where Rashi is deriving this this from. Okay.
Yosef, when he went through Egypt, he was Rabrik, I guess he was
Rabrik. Yeah, in a certain way. Right, yes. It does.
So the Hamad didn't want to be Yosef. That's why Mordechai said no.
Lahabdo.
Okay. that's interesting. Interesting thought. There is a Yosef.
There's a parallel. They're both things. It's the
same language. The whole Avraham and riding through the street. It's all there.
And furthermore, the second most powerful person in charge.
Yeah, it's the viceroy and the ring. And there's a lot of connections there.
Yosef never wanted to usurp.
Right. Yosef was very content. Right. So that is
a political issue, not a religious issue.
That could be. That could absolutely be.
I just want to add, this is note that Haman did not have the power to take action directly against Mordechai at this point.
And that meant by the fact that the Megillah tells us he needed the permission of the king.
And that he kept on violating it and nothing
and
was done.
Correct, that's a great point. That's a great point. Now I just want to share with you.
So Mordechai wanted to avoid empowering Haman by bowing down to him when he didn't have to. Power struggle.
Well, you read it as a power struggle until it became a religious issue. So it's either you got to choose at some point. Yeah.
Why?
Why? Yeah. Because if it's a power struggle,
since what has religion been divorced from power?
Because the reason why is because if it's a power issue, then we either Mordechai is inside. Yeah, the Medrash is painting him as a tzaddik. And let's accept that Medrash for a minute. I have no problem with the Medrash.
Okay.
Once you accept it, that the Medrash is painting him in halakhic terms. But once you do that, you got to abandon the other part. Because then it's not a power struggle. Then all of a sudden, even if they had no context whatsoever, other than, you know, Haman could have been a nobody, but Haman's going to make himself like God, then Mordechai isn't going to bow for him. So here's one of those places where you can't buy both stories at the same time. Because if you do, you're either going to walk down the halakhic track, and that's an interesting way to go, although there's a lot of places to get bumped off there. Or you can walk down the political track.
Okay, today.
But hold on. I want to consider two other tracks.
Okay.
Source number 10. We're going to see two other midrashim, and you'll tell me what you make of them. Both of them are fascinating for their own reasons. Source number 10. Here's the midrash. Amar Rabbi Chanina, my dechsev cholzei neinu shaveli. Why does the Megillah say that Haman said, even though he had everything in the world, he had all the riches, neinu shaveli? As long as this one guy doesn't bow down to me, it's all worthless. It is a very bothersome formulation. It's the bee in his bonnet. I mean, why is it so important to him? I mean, the other 100,000 people are bowing down. He's powerful. He's rich. What's the, psychologically, what's bothering him so much that...
Because he saw that Mordechai already brought down a revolution against the king.
What do you mean?
When the king, when they were plotted against the king, Mordechai overheard,
right.
Picked off the king.
Right.
And you start to speak again.
And therefore, you're saying Mordechai somehow... Okay.
Mordechai's a problem with that.
Okay. So Medrash is a slightly different, track. What's that? Right, he is a Shin Bet of the time.
Yoshe Bashar Melech.
Right, he's there. He's an important guy.
He's a spy.
He's a presence. Let's call him a presence.
Let's see what this Medrash says. The middle of the first line in source number 10. Melamed shekol beis kinazav shel Haman harasha hayu chatukim al libo. Okay, this is really stunning. The Medrash says that the entire treasury, or let's say the sum total of all that was in the treasury of the king, was chakuk, was literally, if you take this Medrash literally, was inscribed on his heart. That means he had a tattoo, he had a pendant,
or he had the code to the safe.
Whatever it was on his heart. Thought about all the time. Ubishashu roes Mordechai, Amar kolzein inu shoveli. So he sort of pointed to himself, and he said, when he saw Mordechai not bowing, he said, all of this, all the treasures, worthless to me. Yishum deroel and Mordechai yoshev b'shar ha-melech. When he saw Mordechai sitting at the king's gate, Amar kol zein inu shoveli, second interpretation, it's all meaningless to me, why? Kid Rav Chista. As Rav Chista said, what did Rav Chista say? Zama Rav Chista. Zeba b'proz boli, zeba b'proz boti. And this is a little hard to translate, but somehow it means, coming back to the source that Manny cited earlier, that Haman and Mordechai were somehow pitted against each other in the court of the king. One was a senator from one party, one was a senator from another party, one had a monetary claim, the other had a different monetary, whatever the source of struggle, the Medrash is pointing to this. Hamachas. And a little history, the Medrash says. Who are these people? We're introduced to them midlife, but let me tell you about their background. Pam achas nasan amelach mama. Bishagram berosh geisos. I'm sorry. Bishagram berosh geisos lichvosha samadina. You help me out with the translation. It's a little opaque. But one time, the king distributed or let flow from his treasury into the hands of some strong men. Enough money to be able to, let's say, conquer the particular state or the particular country. Whatever it is, he's planning a rebellion or he's somehow starting a war. And the money trickles down into the hands of these mercenaries, let's say. Yeah. Natal Haman Maman Shalo, V'achlo V'lo Yishtayelo Maman. Okay, so Haman was one of these guys who got a portion of it, but he blew it. Okay, he got the check from the government, he went out and spent it the next day, and nothing on reserve.
Right, he bought
it in jail. Right. I don't know exactly what happened here, but somehow the war started, whatever happened, he needed the money, and he didn't have it. Mordechai was a little more conservative, he spent half, but he still had half at his disposal. Haman etzel Mordechai. Haman came to Mordechai. Now Amar lo, he said, Halivani mamon zeh shiviyadecha. So could just make me a loan. Jews are reputed to make loans. Could you make me a loan? So Amar lo, so Mordechai says back to him, Ein ani melavcha, ela im kein tinkor nafshech le'evedli. He says, I will not make you a loan unless you sell yourself into slavery and become my slave. If you do that, then you got a deal. Kibul al nafsho bilbo, Haman agreed. The kasav lo, hare Haman abdo shel Mordechai, and he wrote the contract, Haman is Mordechai's slave. Zami nafsho the Mordechai betulma dinama, the end of the story is he essentially sold himself to Haman for a loaf of bread. Haynu d'amar le Mordechai, Lahaman abde de kana nifse abde deman nifse deman. Okay, so Mordechai saw Haman parading around with, let's say, the combination to the national treasury, and he said to him, when a slave becomes the owner of something, who really becomes the owner of what the slave what the slave became the owner of? The owner of the slave! The Medrash is saying something, is saying something fascinating. The Medrash is saying, you know why Haman refused to bow down to Haman?
You mean Mordechai?
Something Freudian going on there. Do you know why Mordechai refused to bow down to Haman? Mordechai refused to bow down to Haman because he owned him. Because they had a personal history. It was a history of conflict. Mordechai was up here and Haman was down there. So it ended up being Haman was raised to power. He became the viceroy. The Medrash is basically saying, as a result of, let's say, ego, Mordechai couldn't stomach the fact that lowly Haman, who was his slave, is now requiring that everyone in the palace and everyone in the kingdom, including Mordechai, his former master, bow down to him. So to me, this is really staggering. This Medrash is actually saying something along the lines of what Charles was saying earlier, namely that Mordechai was unjustified in his decision not to bow down to Haman. And if...
Had nothing to do with religion.
Had nothing to do with politics. Had nothing to do with the power struggle. Maybe a little to do with the power struggle. But it was Mordechai's own personal vendetta against Haman that caused him not to bow down.
It was like if Strom Thurmond had to stand up to Barack Obama.
Right, he didn't live long enough to see the dead.
Was this, according to this narrative, was this a way what I tried to almost embarrass Haman for
his him? Yeah.
People could come to Mordechai and say, why aren't you bowing down? And if Mordechai wanted to be really upfront, that guy's my servant.
Yeah.
And he sold himself to me because he needs
nothing. He's the lowliest of the low. He's a piece of bread. He's nothing.
Old ego.
Rachel, do you
want to
say something?
I just don't see
the
baseless sort of purpose on this one. Where Hashem is saying, you know,
it's a faith. This is why don't you accept this as purgatory? Except this is just a spin. This is guys.
Meaning you're right. But Rachel's asking a very important question.
Yeah, so accept
that. Each one of these answers, and again, some of them are a stretch and some of them maybe are not a stretch, and we'll see the fourth, which I find the most fascinating. But there's a real fundamental problem which you raised at the beginning. How could it be? How could Mordechai be justified in failing to bow down to Haman? He endangered the lives of thousands, if not tens of thousands of Jews. For what principle? There's nothing in the Torah that says you can't bow down to a guy who is the vice president. It's fine. We have plenty of precedents. We have precedents in Kanaas. Yeah, you bow down to the king of Israel. It's fine. So what's the big deal? So the first two strands of thought that we saw say, if we squeeze and turn and twist, we can find a way that really Mordechai was justified. Some form or fashion, there was something about Haman, it was about Azara, he made himself into a god. So Mordechai had no choice, but at the end of the day, he's justified. This third answer is saying, actually, you know what? Mordechai was not justified. Mordechai was actually guilty of wrongly endangering the lives of the Jews for personal ego. It's staggering that the Medrash would be so hypercritical of Mordechai. Judge?
I don't think you take the Medrash literally.
No.
Close enough here to go prop the hop doesn't work in the Bible.
Who?
Just because most of the calendar doesn't mean it came before. It's an example of logic. In the Bible, it means something. After, Haman did not seek just to punish Mordechai. He sought to punish all the Jews. Ergo, Mordechai, knowing this would happen from something in the past, says, I've got to take down Haman. I can't let him know that he's the Lord over us. I must take him down in some fashion. First part is that I'm not going to show obeisance to him. I think this is what the Bible, the Midrash is saying. It's not epic in a literal term. It's that he
is low and I am high, and for him to become high at my expense, I will not accept the reward.
Okay, I think that's a valid reading of this match. Manny?
This is in line with Al's comment also. The way I read this medrash is Mishum Deroel Amaris HaYoshev B'Sharam Melech. He is angry not because he doesn't bow down and they told him he doesn't bow down. He is primarily angry because he's sitting in the court.
Yeah.
He has a position.
Yeah.
And he sees that he still has this position, and because he has a position, he is strong enough not to bow down. And he still thinks that he can reverse it and take down.
Okay, I think that's very plausible.
And he's not really endangering the Jews.
Oh, okay. That
because he will be able to...
Two sides of that argument. Maybe yes, maybe no.
And he's got his Esther in there. But right. Aside from that, the reason Haman, according to this, picked the Jews as a people to destroy is he sold them. All the Kristallnacht and pogroms of history all had a financial aspect to it. They wanted to plunder the Jews.
Maybe
here we're selling the Jews to Atash Vera.
Maybe the Jews deserve to get punished. Maybe they aren't doing the things properly.
I'm just talking about the...
We have read.
Why? It's the beginning of the year that the Megillah says that. At the beginning of the Megillah. They're always the Jews are guilty of doing certain things that maybe they deserve to get punished.
We always deserve to get punished.
Why? Why is that true?
Get saved.
It says it in the beginning. They think Shushan instead of Yerushalayim. They have a chance to go back to Israel. They don't go back to Israel. Maybe they deserve to get punished here.
So okay. Hitler is a nation to come.
That's right.
Jews don't deserve to get punished.
Nobody
appoints Jews. Nobody appoints people to punish.
The measure is just as good as what he's saying.
Okay, let me just start to wrap up with
source number 11.
Yeah. Look at source number 11. In the interest of time, okay, Alan, hang on. In the interest of time, okay. In the interest of time, we don't have to see the entire source. I just want to hone in on two key lines. The last two lines of source number 11. Okay, the Medrash is citing a debate between the elders of the generation and Mordechai as to whether or not it was right for Mordechai to do this. Okay. And then the Medrash takes off on a tangent and says that Haman and Mordechai had a conversation that was unrecorded in the Megillah. It's an amazing Medrash because it says that Haman started quoting scriptures. Okay, you love it.
This is standard.
Of course.
Standard Midrash is standard.
That's great. So he had a great line. He said, why don't you bow down to me? Amron le, zikno halo ishtachabel zikni. This is Haman talking to Mordechai. He says, your great-great-great-grandfather bowed down to my great-great-grandfather. Hagahu de Amar. Flip the page for 1 second. I have the source for you on the first page. From source number 4. Okay? Just remember the lineage here. Haman is the Megillah says, from Agagi. Okay? Agag is from the nation of? From Amalek. Right? And Amalek is the grandson of? Of Esau. Okay? And where's Mordechai from? Mordechai is from Binyamin. So here's the conversation. Okay? So Haman says to Mordechai, your great-grandfather, Yaakov, bowed down to my great-grandfather, Esau. Right? Source number 4. That great meeting, that's why I said at the beginning, I wanted to come back to Yaakov, who was the subject of our entire course the last 6 weeks. What happened? This is where we left off Yaakov last week. Okay, Yaakov gets up in the morning, he sees that Esav is approaching, and he starts to put the children in the charge of the wives. Lines up the whole family. Yaakov goes right up to the front of the line. He bows 7 times to his brother Esau. Haman knows the story, he knows the Torah, he knows Perek Lam Gimel of Sefer Bereishis, and he quotes it to Haman. Haman quotes it to Mordechai. Keep doing that. He quotes it to Mordechai. He says, why don't you bow down to me? We have precedent for this. We can all be friends. And Mordechai says back, no, right? Rafi, do you look and you guessed it. Right? This is a great Talmudic twist. He says, no, I have Fiva Dayal Nola Binyamin. Who's my grandfather? It's true, I'm from Binyamin. And Binyamin wasn't born yet. It was Yaakov and his 11 sons. Binyamin wasn't around. So he says, my heritage? I don't bow.
Except I'm his mother's son.
Except on his mother's side. Right, but on my father's side, I'm not from the Bowers. What a wild...
His mother...
What a wild message.
His mother died because she took the Abba of the Zohar from her okay. father.
Okay, hold off on that
question. That's why she died.
That's right.
She died because she died.
Let's hold off on Rachel for a moment. What I would argue is at stake in this Medrash is really something fundamental about the Megillah, something fundamental about Mordechai, and really something fundamental about the Jewish people, and it all comes back to Yaakov. Flip back for a moment to source number 12 on the second page. It's true, Mordechai gives this sort of tongue-in-cheek up, and Yaman wasn't even around. What Mordechai is really saying to Haman is you have to read the rest of the story. It's true, Yaakov bowed to Esau. But just read a few more psukim, okay, which is what I want to do with you right now. And to really hone in on what it is Mordechai is arguing. It's a blow-away chapter 33. And it forever affects the destiny of the Jewish people. Source number 12, it's a beautiful scene. Yaakov and Esav are reconciled. Yaakov's dreading seeing Esav. He thinks maybe his brother still wants to kill him after all these years. He offers him this gift. Esav says, yeah, well, it's fine, I have everything. Yaakov says, just take the gift. Esav says, okay, I'll take the gift. And they hug, and they kiss, they cry, it's beautiful. The scene is about to close. And who starts talking? Esav. And Esav in source number 12, verse 12, says, Vayomar, Nisav Nelcha Vyelcha Lenivdecha. Why don't we start to journey together? We'll walk arm in arm, side by side. You have your people, I have my people. We've been reconciled after 36 years of not seeing one another. We're brothers after all. Amazing. Nisav Nelcha Vyelcha Lenivdecha. I'll walk right opposite you. We'll go arm in arm together. Right into the sunset. We don't have to fight anymore.
We'll intermarry.
Yaakov says, yeah, why not? Yaakov says, Vayomer Elav Adoni. He says, Adoni, my master, my older brother. Yodeya ki ha-yeladim rakim, v'yatzon da-bakar, alos, alai, v'utfakum, yamachad, v'mesu kol atzon. I have little kids. We have these flocks. We won't be able to keep up at your pace. You go ahead, Esav. We'll go just at a slow pace, the pace of the animals, the pace of the children. We'll catch up. You go ahead. It's fine. Esav doesn't take the hit. Esav says, Vayomer Esav. He doesn't just drop it, he persists. He says, no, we can work it out, it's fine. If that's your main concern, I'll appoint some people from my group. I have these 400 men. They'll help you. We'll go together. It'll be great, Yaakov. It's no problem. Yaakov cuts him off mid-sentence, and he says, Regesh, Vayomer Ramazet in Tzachin Beinan. Just, why can't you just, I just want to, it's a half sentence, he's stuttering, he's mumbling, he can't even make a cogent argument. He says, I just want to find favor in your eyes. Yaakov, he doesn't even have a cogent response. He offered up his best excuse, we're too slow, Esav has has a compelling argument. It's okay, we'll go at your pace, I'll help you out, it's no problem. And Yaakov starts to mumble and to stutter, and I just want to find favor in your eyes. I'm not coming with you. And they split. Vayeshev Vayomu Esav L'Darko Seira. Esav takes off and he goes his way. Yaakov Nasa Sukosa, Yaakov goes his way. They never meet again until their father's funeral. And of course, a lifelong feud between them that persists. Ad Hayom Hazeh. Like Chazal say, it's the descendants of Yaakov that are Edom, that are Christianity, that's the Crusades, the Inquisition. That's the...
And they're in Yeshiva and Bnei Brak.
And they're in Yeshiva and Bnei Brak. Okay. Some of them are... All because Yaakov refused Esav's embrace. He could have ended the whole story. They could have walked arm in arm. I would suggest that Mordechai is pointing out to this epilogue to the story. Yeah, it's true. It started out with Yaakov bowing down. It started out with Yaakov bowing down to Esau. And there are moments when that's the right move. And for Yaakov at that moment, it was the right move. But equally right, as evidenced by how the narrative plays out, sometimes it's the right move to say, it's okay, we're not going to go arm in arm. You go your way, and I'll go mine. The whole tension of the Megillah is this conflict. You have two choices. You have the Zeishtil, we're going to lay low, we're not going to make trouble, we're not going to ruffle any feathers, and it's okay, there's a government that doesn't like us too much, but we'll manage, and we'll be okay. Or you could stand up and say, no, we're actually not doing that anymore. Here's where we draw the line, whatever the issues are, whether it's intermarriage or at some point we stand up and say, no, we refuse. I know that you want to be partners with us, and I know that you want us to acculturate, and I know that you want us to be integrated and to break down the ghetto walls, whatever the case may be over the course of history. At some point, Mordechai is saying there's a model from the life of Yaakov where as much as they try to embrace us and as much as they put their arm around us, sometimes you have to walk away. It's not an easy call. And the Medrash is actually saying Mordechai took a lot of flack for it because there was a whole group of people who said, no, Mordechai, why are you making a stink? We could just... Zeishtil, it's okay. We could just blend in. No one even recognizes you're Jewish. No one's going to know. And Esther said exactly the same thing. And Mordechai, at a particular moment, and whatever it was that threw him over the edge, I don't know, religious, political, whatever it was, drew the line in the sand and said, Ad kan v'li yoser, just as my great-grandfather Yaakov once did, at some point, even when they come and they say, I want to give you a hug, whatever you want, you can come to our schools and you can eat in our restaurant, whatever the examples are for the particular generation, at some point, someone gets up and says, we want to be on your team, but we have certain places where we draw the line, and if we cross that line, then we lose our identity. So perhaps the Medrash, and I think very beautifully and very poignantly by alluding to this beautiful struggle between Yaakov and Esau. And I think it's a struggle for Yaakov. Because how nice would it have been to just be arm in arm with Esau and not have to be looking over your shoulders, my brother, hate my guts. Do I have to be in conflict all the time? But for whatever reason, and again, it could change from moment to moment, from context to context. Yaakov decided in his moment, and Mordechai decided in his moment, this is where we say, Ad kan v'li yoser, I can't go any further with you. And perhaps that's the Medrash's answer to our question. That's why Mordechai refused to bow. He had a line. Over the line, I will not cross.
I think that's a very good insight into the Megillah. I would just like to add that the Medrash is used in the Talmud very often. Esav are the Romans.
Yeah.
And Yaakov are Jews, and the question is, should they revolt, or should they get along, should they go along with the Roman rule or not? And Esav is a code word for Pharaoh burial.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. Two more. Sylvia and then David?
I have something in the modern period, you know, during the time of Moses Mendelssohn.
Yeah.
Where he was trying to, I think it was the Haskalah, is that the
Haskalah? Yeah, it's a great point. It's exactly the same tension.
So he thought that we could sort of like integrate modern with the religious. But if you look at his family, not one grandchild. But
you can look at Samson Raphael Hirsch and say the same thing. Okay, we're willing to integrate.
Why?
Yeah, Samson Raphael Hirsch said,
"What about the restoration symphony?" And he ends up with
the Elijah symphony. Right. Yeah.
Right. So Samson Raphael Hirsch said, "You know, I'm going in, and we can be a little, you know, in the modern world, but you know, we're not
right
in the time." The Haskalah said, "We want to wear canonicals, and we're going to dress like our contemporaries in the synagogue, and we're going to make our shuls look like the non-Jewish houses of worship. We're going to have an organ." Some of that was, you know, ended up being accepted into the mainstream. We came to Arvin and rehearsed that, okay, here's what we could do and here's what we can't. David?
I see one big difference between these two stories. In the first story, this isn't, Mordecai doesn't do this quietly. He makes a big deal over not bowing, and it's very obvious to everyone. In the case of Yaakov and Esav, Yaakov tells Esav, we'll be right behind you. We'll be right behind you. Esav goes ahead, and Yaakov goes the other way. Esav doesn't even know until we kind of
It's a good point. I would just conclude with one final thought, which is that enmeshed in this whole conversation, this whole debate, is a personal piece. And if you think, and we've been talking about this for the last 2 weeks, the personality of Yaakov is such that he'll always rely on his silver tongue to get him out of it. Right? I'll just convince you. It's fine. You go ahead, and I'll give you some line. Right? The way that he was able to feed people lines his whole life to achieve his goal. And again, we don't have as much information on Mordecai, but if you look at his personality, he's the guy who starts wearing sackcloth in the street and making a scene, and he's the one who's very forceful of Esther. It's not you, it's going to be somebody else. He's someone who is perfectly willing to make a scene, right, and to make waves. And again, it's hard to say how much of that is the context, how much of that is the personality, but I think it's a great point. Something definitely worth considering.